we will be able to provide that gas to Fairbanks and to other communities along the way at a significantly lower cost.
A new proposal for supplying gas to interior and south central Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, charting a course to safer shipping along the Aleutian Islands.
It was a homegrown answer to a challenge that we were seeing over and over again.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
It was anticipated that the U.S. House would vote on a so-called Plan B tonight that would have raised taxes on those who make $1 million per year. The president had forwarded an idea to raise taxes on those who make $400,000 per year. The House has now put off the vote because of a lack of support to pass it. APRN's Peter Granitz tells us the holdup in Congress is not unusual.
This Congress has never acted quickly. They always act under deadline. Remember, they gave themselves a year to come up with a plan, a deficit reduction plan, and they didn't do it. And that's why we're here. And now we're looking, you know, a week away, a little more than a week away before all these tax increases and spending cuts kick in. So they don't work well. They're kind of like a high school student who waits to the end, or a college student who just procrastinates and writes the paper the night before, or studies for the test. That's what they do best. They don't do things. They don't really legislate like previous Congresses. And then there's also the really sad sticking point that, you know, Senator Daniel Inouye passed away this week, and that slowed down the Senate. Not that the Senate was really producing much legislation, but it means that a number of senators will be flying to Hawaii on Saturday to attend a memorial service. There's unlikely to be a weekend session, which many people thought would happen. And something to note is that, you know, the lawmakers want to be home for the holidays. Just like everybody else, it's unfortunate that, you know, their staffs are unlikely to make it home and see their loved ones. They'll probably be stuck in Washington, D.C. because they have to, you know, write all this legislation.
Well, what can we expect? What's coming, do you think?
That is the question that everybody wants to know the answer to, and not many folks do. I don't even think Speaker John Boehner and the president know the answer to that question yet, though there is speculation that they are closer than they lead on. But the idea that a grand bargain between the president and speaker about a deficit, long-term deficit reduction, that's so unlikely at this point. You know, they don't have the time to actually write that legislation. So what we're going to see, if there is an agreement, and that's not a guarantee, it would be the framework for what's to come, and that bill would direct the tax writing committees in the new year to say, this is the constraints you need to work within. And then that would zero out. They would say that would save enough money that they wouldn't have to enforce this sequester.
All right, Peter, thanks for that update.
Thank you.
APRN's Peter Granitz reporting from Washington, D.C. A war of words has erupted between two oil and industry players over who exactly was responsible for paying workers on Buccaneer Energy's jackup rig Endeavor. While the rig sits idle at the Homer Harbor more than 4 months after its arrival in Alaska, a lawsuit between Buccaneer and the Endeavor's former operator, Archer Drilling, has been filed in Texas court. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the details.
Neither Buccaneer Energy nor Archer Drilling would go on tape for this story, but the clash between the two companies plays out in legal papers and press releases. The trouble started here in Homer last week when plumbers, welders, and other workers who had been contracted to work on the Endeavor jackup rig walked off the job, upset that they hadn't been paid in weeks. Buccaneer, an Australian company founded in 2007 that has its U.S. headquarters in Houston, Texas, immediately came out with a statement blaming the rig's operator, Archer Drilling, for the problem. Jay Marakis of JMR Worldwide, Buccaneer's public relations office, said the company had severed ties with Archer Drilling and had hired a new operator, Spartan Drilling, to oversee the rig. Marakis said Buccaneer considers itself paid in full to Archer and would work to make sure that the rig workers who are owed money would be paid for their services. But a $6 million lawsuit filed in Harris County, Texas Tuesday tells a very different story, claiming that Buccaneer Energy prematurely pushed the 30-year-old jackup rig into service without regard to its decrepit condition. Archer Drilling is suing for money it says is owed for helping to prepare the Endeavor for drilling in Alaska. The language in the lawsuit does not mince words. From the beginning of the two companies' relationship in 2011, the lawsuit says Buccaneer, quote, undermined and underfunded the project. The lawsuit goes on, by favoring wishful thinking over hard facts, Buccaneer turned a blind eye to the amount of time, money, and effort needed to bring such a rig up to operational levels. Archer claims in the lawsuit that the Endeavor had no business leaving Singapore earlier this year before needed work was completed, and Buccaneer's ambitious plans were, quote, matched neither by the funding they provided or the realities of the rig's condition. After more than 70 Homer area workers walked off the job last week, and after several attempts to collect payment, Archer says in the lawsuit that it was the one who terminated its contract with Buccaneer December 13th. The lawsuit demands damages in excess of $6 million and requests a jury trial. Maracas responded Thursday with a press release saying that Archer Drilling never lived up to its end of the bargain and is at least partially to blame for the Endeavor rig's unexpected four-month stay here in Homer. In the release, Buccaneer Finance Director Dean Galagos is quoted as saying he is disappointed to see the matter come to this point and that Buccaneer was, quote, left with no other choice than to terminate Archer Drilling's work on the Endeavor. Archer's lawsuit, says Galagos, is, quote, entirely without merit. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
State lawmakers today heard an update on a proposal to get natural gas from the North Slope to South Central Alaska. The project concentrates on in-state delivery and involves a slightly larger gas line than previous plans. House Speaker Mike Chenault and Representative Mike Hawker have been pushing a pipeline in recent years and say they plan to reintroduce a gas pipeline bill this next session. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
The Joint In-State Gas Caucus met in Anchorage to get an update from the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Frank Richards is the Pipeline and Government Affairs Manager with the agency. He presented an update on the Alaska Standalone Pipeline. He says the project will run a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Beluga Point McKenzie, but it has a new design premise, the main feature being a slightly larger pipeline with lower pressure.
But what this also means is that we will be able to provide that gas to Fairbanks and to other communities along the way at a significantly lower cost.
Previous plans included a 24-inch pipeline, plus costly processing facilities and compressor stations along the way to handle higher pressure. Richards says the plan still calls for moving 500 million cubic feet of gas per day, the AGIA limitation, but Richards says the changes have many benefits.
We're going to eliminate costly facilities along the line. We're going to have industry standard pipes, fittings, and equipment. And we'll have a lean gas case that will still allow for the inclusion of propane if there are propane options or propane needs along the line to be met to meet interior Alaska's needs. And then the lean gas means that greater access for Alaskan communities, no need for expensive straddle plants, lower operating costs.
Richards also reported that the environmental impact statement for the more than 700-mile-long pipeline is complete and that the agency has acquired the necessary state rights of way. Federal rights of way are still being sought. The legislature created the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation to advance a standalone pipeline in 2010. State Representative Mike Chenault pushed for the gas line along with Representative Hawker last year in the legislature. It passed the House but died in the Senate. Hawker says it's an important measure.
We have to look at getting natural gas into the hands of Alaskans as a public works project. Just like highways and sewers, water and sewer systems are public works projects. Right now, with the cost of energy in the interior and with the looming natural gas shortage here in Cook Inlet, I can assure every one of us as elected officials that the first time the pilot lights go out, a house goes cold, or you flip the switch and the lights don't go on, our public is going to be asking, why didn't you make this a sufficient priority.
Hawker says legislators are trying to get a jump on the session, preparing new pipeline legislation, and already have a 42-page bill. Officials estimate the project will cost $7.7 billion. The AGDC is asking for $400 million from the legislature in 2013 to fund the project. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a bad air quality problem gets worse in Fairbanks.
Comparatively speaking, Fairbanks certainly has a serious air pollution problem with respect to fine particulate matter.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
The Bristol Bay Forever Citizen Initiative cleared the Lieutenant Governor's office today, which means the initiative's sponsors can start collecting the necessary signatures to put the initiative on the ballot. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The Bristol Bay Forever Initiative seeks to require legislative approval for large-scale mines in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. Anders Gustafsson is the executive director of the Renewable Resources Coalition, which is backing the initiative. He says that the original Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve legislation added a layer of protection to the fishery from oil and gas development. This initiative would expand that to meet what he says are the current threats.
So what we're doing is basically amending that piece of legislation to say, hey, if it's good enough for oil and gas, then we should probably have the same kind of review for large-scale mines.
If the initiative makes it onto the ballot, and if the voters approved it at the polls, the Alaska State Legislature would have to give final authorization for the permitting of large-scale mines like Pebble in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. Gustafsson thinks this ballot initiative takes a more balanced approach than other initiatives Alaskans have seen over the years, and also shouldn't be construed as a hurdle for potential mines elsewhere in the state.
So it's very specific in its geography. It doesn't apply to mines elsewhere in the state. It's really about protecting Bristol Bay salmon.
The backers and sponsors now must gather signatures, and a lot of them, in order to put the initiative on the 2014 ballot. They need a minimum of 10% of the number of people who voted in the previous general election, which means they need 30,169 signatures gathered from three-quarters of all House districts in the state, and they have a year to get them. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
It's been 8 years since the Selandang IU cargo ship lost control and split in half outside Unalaska, spilling hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil. Six crew members died. Since then, a team of consultants and maritime experts have been studying ways to keep the Aleutian Islands safe from passing vessels. Many agree that a robust rescue tug would help. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, there's a lot of disagreement over how soon the tug is needed and whose job it is to acquire it.
The Selandang IU wasn't an isolated incident. Large cargo vessels regularly run into trouble when traveling on the Great Circle shipping route. And in 2010, it was the Golden Seas, a 740-foot cargo ship en route to the United Arab Emirates from Canada. It lost power near Adak and started drifting towards shore. Shell Oil had a heavy-duty contract tug at the dock in Dutch Harbor. Despite bad weather and high seas, the Shell tug intercepted the drifting vessel, and what could have been another disaster wasn't. But Rick Steiner says that was dumb luck.
Where there just happened to be a tug available. Thank you, Shell, for that. We can't just do this so haphazardly. And just if there is an event, just hope that there's a vessel out there.
Steiner was part of a group that lobbied for some Selandang IU settlement money to fund a risk assessment to figure out what it would take to prevent another disaster. A dedicated rescue tug was at the top of his list. Now, Steiner says the study has dragged on for too long, and he says it's being used as an excuse not to act.
If they were doing a risk assessment while putting interim protections in place, chartering an interim rescue tug to be on standby while they sort out the permanent system, that's one thing, but they're not doing that.
Leslie Pearson is the project manager for the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment. Right now, her team is starting the second half of their review. They'll be looking at logistics and ways to pay for safety tools needed in the Aleutians, including tug and salvage service. Pearson says her team hasn't even talked about hiring a tug while they do their study.
I know everybody's patients tend to run out when money gets put towards studies, but in order for big-ticket risk reduction options to be implemented, you've got to have the information in your back pocket in order to ask for funding in order to implement them, like a permanently stationed rescue tug.
The idea is that it's easier to get state support for something as nebulous as shipping safety when you can present a finished product or a comprehensive plan. That's the approach that Unalaska Mayor Shirley Marquardt favors. Marquardt is an advisor on the risk assessment panel. She's also the backer of two emergency resources for Unalaska, a towing kit and a mooring buoy outside of town that can hold a broken down cargo ship. Marquardt says it was easier to build those tools independently than to ask the state to move first.
We're just able to move a whole lot faster on our own, and that was just, it was a simple, it was a homegrown answer to a challenge that we were seeing over and over again.
But when it comes to a rescue tug, things get complicated. Both Steiner, the activist, and Pearson, who's running the risk assessment, say the state would have to step in to pay for a rescue tug while a permanent plan is worked out. Unalaska's mayor would be the clear choice to lobby for that kind of help. But Marquardt says she would never consider doing that, because even though it's a concrete safety improvement, a rescue tug is also a logistical nightmare.
We're not going to come and say, yeah, give us a rescue tug, because the first question would be, where are you going to put it? Is it going to patrol or sit? Who's going to fund it? Who actually has to use it? Who's going to maintain it? And how long are you going to keep it there? You're just going to bring it up in the winter or have it all year round? And we'd go, oh, I don't know. I don't know. To every one of them. I would never do that.
Those are the questions that the risk assessment will try to answer in their study. Pearson thinks a solution will be a collaboration between the shipping industry and the state and federal governments, but a concrete agreement could be years off. In the meantime, Steiner, the activist, wants to see tariffs collected on cargo to help pay for a tug and more detailed vessel monitoring right now. He's been lobbying the state and federal governments this month to lay the groundwork for that. So the next time there's a Golden Seas threatening to run aground in the Aleutians, responders know exactly who to call. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Work has begun on the gas field at Point Thompson on the North Slope. The ExxonMobil Corporation is working to connect the field to an existing pipeline 22 miles away. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The subject of a court battle that was settled between the state and ExxonMobil. The Point Thompson gas field on the edge of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is thought to be necessary to supply any large diameter pipeline to get North Slope gas to market. The company is notorious for keeping its public relations office on a tight leash, and in the case of Point Thompson, they won't say anything beyond confirming that the project is going ahead. The project's Army Corps of Engineers permit, awarded in October, describes a series of three gravel pads for wells strung along the coast, connected by 18 miles of gravel roads and 16 miles of pipe. Two wells have been drilled, and three more are planned to feed a processing plant that will extract the liquids or condensates out of the gas. The permit allows 149 miles of seasonal ice roads to construct a pipeline from the processing plant 22 miles westward to an existing pipeline at the Badami oil field. Badami was originally developed by BP but never produced to expectations because the oil is so thick, and is now operated by Savant Energy and delivers about 1,500 barrels a day the rest of the way to the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Savant has applied to expand Badami by 10,000 acres for more drilling. Savant is also not talking to the press. The liquids produced by ExxonMobil could potentially be used to improve the oil that's coming out of Badami, and so far no terms for an agreement between the two companies has been disclosed. Another reason for confidentiality could be pending litigation. ExxonMobil agreed to its production plan as part of a settlement with the state, which threatened to revoke its leases at Point Thompson if no progress was shown. Under the agreement, the company is supposed to be feeding natural gas liquids through the Badami pipeline by winter of 2015, just 3 years from now. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The former owner of an Anchorage road and parking lot painting and striping business has been sentenced for illegally disposing of hazardous waste. Federal prosecutors say 43-year-old William Duran Vizera Jr. illegally disposed of more than 200,000 pounds of highly flammable hazardous waste in Anchorage. Prosecutors say he did it after being told it would cost him tens of thousands of dollars to properly dispose of the materials. Vizera, president of Precision Pavement Markings, abandoned more than 320 55-gallon drums and dozens of 5-gallon paint pails and 2-gallon totes. He pleaded guilty in August. U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beislein sentenced Vizera on Wednesday to 15 months in prison. He also was ordered to pay more than $395,000 in restitution to two victims for cleanup costs. Fairbanks is on track for the worst December air quality on record. Cold, stagnant conditions combined with emissions from heating and other sources are resulting in fine particulate pollution in excess of federal standards. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, with more extreme cold in the forecast, the prognosis isn't good.
Fairbanks' worst air quality normally doesn't hit until late December and January, but as of early this week, the city had already had 8 days this month that violated the Environmental Protection Agency's standard for what's called PM2.5, tiny particles in smoke that lodge deep in the lungs, causing short- and long-term health problems. Fairbanks North Star Borough Transportation Director Glenn Miller says the number of exceedances measured at a downtown monitoring site is high.
You know, we're halfway through the month, and we already have more exceedances than we have in the last 2 years. So if this continues, especially with the severity of the exceedances that we're having, this will certainly be the worst month that we've recorded.
Miller says the downtown monitor registered 3 exceedances last December, 9 in 2010, and 14 in December 2009. A new monitoring site in North Pole has also measured numerous bad air days this month, but there's no past data to compare it with. State Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Program Director Alice Edwards says Fairbanks area wintertime pollution can rival that of much larger urban areas.
Comparatively speaking, Fairbanks certainly has a serious air pollution problem with respect to fine particulate matter. On any given day, our community may look worse than others in the country, but they may be higher in different times of the year.
The state and borough continue to discuss ways to reduce Fairbanks area smoke. The long-range solution is availability of lower-cost, cleaner-burning natural gas for heating. In the nearer term, the borough's Miller says an incentive program paying people who have alternative heating devices to use oil instead of wood on bad air days is an option.
Individuals are burning wood for a good reason, because they can't afford home heating oil. So unless there's some other option for them that's going to be just as cheap as wood, they're not going to switch.
A heating incentive program could be part of a fine particulate pollution compliance plan. The borough and state are working to get into the Environmental Protection Agency. The state's Edwards says the pollution problem is being looked at on two fronts.
We have sort of these nuisance types of situations where you have an individual source that seems to be causing a localized problem. And then we have the greater, broader area-wide particulate issue. So right now we're focusing on both sides of that coin, but primarily trying to find the area-wide solutions.
A ballot proposition approved by Fairbanks area voters in October stripped borough authority to regulate heating devices, and pollution violation enforcement now rests with the state. Edwards says the DEC is building cases against two outdoor boiler operators who have been the source of many public complaints, a slow process that could ultimately lead to legal action. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
For veterans without military ID cards, several pieces of documentation were required to visit the Alaska Office of Veterans Affairs, located on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage, including a driver's license, vehicle registration, and proof of insurance. That's no more now that the office has moved off the base. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has the story.
The walls were bare and some of the chairs were borrowed, but the Alaska Office of Veterans Affairs Tuesday celebrated its move into new offices on DeBar Road in East Anchorage. Joe Fields is chair of the Veterans Advisory Council to the governor and the State Office of Veterans Affairs, which he says provides services directly or indirectly to a large percentage of Alaskans.
Veterans are both male and female. Veterans are from World War II to current conflicts. They have a variety of different needs. Some have extreme medical needs, some have retirement needs, some have educational needs. It's always a body in transition. But as Verdi had said, we have 77,000 veterans in the state, and connect that to their families, it's about 230,000, or half the population, roughly, about a third of the population, is related to a veteran.
Department head Verdi Bowen says the Alaska Office of Veterans Affairs assists veterans in applying for federal services as well as state programs.
We provide help on education programs. We provide help on filing disability claims and compensation and pension. We also help them attain their medical benefits that they've earned through the military, through the VA. On the state side, we have home loans. We have tax breaks on their homes, hunting and fishing license. We have land purchases, education programs.
Advisory Council member John Gwynn of Bethel says veterans' needs vary depending on where they live.
We're from areas all over the state of Alaska. Like I said, I'm from Bethel. I have different needs for my veterans, including transportation, money problems, travel problems, health problems, than Anchorage does. So we put all these things together and try to help advise a solution for all this type of things.
Council member Sue Ellen Wright Novak says the council had worked for a dozen years to get the office moved from the joint Elmendorf-Richardson military base.
This is the answer that the Veterans Affairs has been looking for a long time, because we don't have the problem of veterans who don't have access to the base and can't get on the base anymore with the security issues we now have, that they can come right here.
The State Office of Veterans Affairs has offices in Juneau, Fairbanks, Kenai, and Wasilla, as well as Anchorage. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Daisha Eaton and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtec.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtec.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.